Dave.
No, no, so this is irritation.
I should probably add a Y to that name. That'd be better. Then everybody'd get it right.
Take three. This is Barry Tyker, the UW Oral History Project. Today is December 7th, 1994. I'm in my project office at the Red Gym with Warrington Colescott and Art Hovey, and we are interviewing Jack Damer about his career here at the UW. Warrington, do you want to start things off?
Well, I think your first question was a good place to start, and that is, Jack, if you would sketch sort of where you left from and the circumstances when you were hired on at Wisconsin in 1965.
Well, as I said, I'd gone to undergraduate school at Carnegie Mellon, which was Carnegie Tech at the time, Carnegie Institute of Technology, and it was in the 60s, so I was bound to either wait to get drafted or enlist. So I enlisted in the reserve program at that time and spent 6 months in the Army. While I was in the Army, I was in there with a friend who was also stationed in the White House. And the person at the White House got some contacts for me. And when I got out of the Army, there was an agency that was looking for a graphic designer. So my original emphasis was in illustration, graphic design. And when I held that job for about nine to ten months, and realized that it was a dead end, and then reapplied to grad school at Carnegie Mellon. And I got a TA for the first year, went there for 3 years, graduated in 65, I had done some minor teaching there. Evening classes, things like that. And upon graduation, I sent out approximately 30 letters. And it was very interesting. I sent one to Wisconsin because they were advertising for a printmaker at the time. That was 1965. And the letter was sent to Bob Grilley, who was listed in the magazines or the books at that time as chairperson. And I never got a response, and apparently I never got a response because he was no longer chair, and when he got the letter, I guess he didn't pass it on. So at that time, 30 letters seemed like a lot, where today I guess people send 300, 500 letters. I got a response positive from Wisconsin and one from, I think, somewhere in Florida. And then I heard again about the Wisconsin job and then sent an additional letter. And I then got an interview and flew up here, and you met me and know
right.
how. I remember coming up here because we flew up on a DC-3, remember the ruptured duck airlines, which was North Central, and it was an actual DC-3 because I remember it was sitting on its tail, and I had to walk up the galleyway to get to the seat. And so I interviewed here, did a talk, and incidentally, I guess the thing I forgot to mention is when I went back to Carnegie Mellon for graduate school, I decided to specialize in printmaking. And I think my reason behind that was simply that I thought that all the work I did seemed to benefit from a long developmental period, meaning that I wasn't somebody that just did something and quickly and sort of with one shot. It seemed to be things that started out not very good and it went through long processes of development. And it seemed to me printmaking was something that benefited or could benefit that kind of a ways of approaching. And so I started out doing etchings and woodcuts at Carnegie. And my instructor in lithography was at Tamron at that time. Tamron had just opened. It started in 1960, so the Tamron program, I think he was there in 62. And so he wasn't there the first year I was in grad school. He was off training. And so when he came back from Tamron, he had all this accumulated knowledge about lithography, where basically I was getting along from hand to mouth, you might say, mm-hmm. reading books. There was one instructor there that gave a few tidbits of information.
So there was a direct connection or influence from,
yeah.
from
mm-hmm.
Tamron.
So when he got back, he had all this information, and We started then working together, and I got just completely immersed in that process, doing, I think I did something like 100 images in lithography in the 2 years I was there. And I tried, because it was a printmaking degree, not a general art degree, I had to do everything. So I learned plastic engraving, etching, woodcut. So my final master show literally had all these processes in it. So that gave me then the expert, you might say, the minor expertise in lithography to feel that I could then teach this process.
Were you doing color lithography?
Yeah, I was doing some, not as much. I had done something like most of the color I didn't get into very much until once I got to Wisconsin. And I think that was one of the criticisms of my portfolio, if I remember right, when I got here, was that they all liked my work, but they were concerned about the color. And I think I explained that I technically knew about it, I wasn't comfortable with it in my own work. And I remember interviewing, because I think Robert Nelson was one of the people that I was competing with at the time, who was actually had quite a reputation and had established some fame in the process and in the printmaking. So I think that's where I would start then, what happened then when I got here, if you want to know that. Then.
Before we get to that, did you know anything about UW? And
no, I didn't. I didn't know anything about the program here. The only thing I did know was that Orville Winsand was the chairman at Fine Arts at Carnegie when I left. And Orville eventually became part of this NASDAQ review. Mm. These people had come around to accreditate the department, and he actually was here and had graduated from here, and so personally knew Dean Meeker. And I always remembered that, because when I told him I was going to apply here, he said, well, you know, that's one of the great printmaking departments, and they've got Dean Meeker. And he sort of gave me the impression that I wouldn't be up for it, you know, that I wasn't up to this task. And I can see why he would say that, and, you know, because I was 24, 25 years old at the time. And he did speak highly of the program, but I didn't know much about Wisconsin in relation to Sessler and people like that. I did, in fact, when I started, I think sending out resumes, I just picked areas, I think, of the country that I wouldn't have mind living, and Wisconsin was some place I'd never been to, and it seemed maybe it would be interesting. But I didn't pick it for, as far as I remember, I didn't remember the fact that I had seen Meeker's work, I know, in that magazine, Artist Proof. Remember that was put out a few years?
Right.
It only lasted, and I'd seen his work. And I think, to be frank, I think his work impressed me as a young printmaker more than anybody I had seen. I remember seeing that angel print, or the print with the polymer, the black winged figure. And I just never had seen anything quite like that technically. And I know it's very impressive. So there may have been a sort of a little bit of an overhang of knowing something about his work and then realizing the program here.
Did you go to Carnegie as a hometown?
Yes, I was born and raised in Pittsburgh. In fact, several of the people I went to college with, Chuck Schmidt, actually, he was my best friend, and he's the one that went to the Army. And he went in the Army for 2 years and was stationed at the White House. And he was doing lettering at the White House for Jackie Kennedy at the time. He was lettering their resumes, and not resumes, but their invitations, because he knew his script very well. And that's where I got the lead then for that job in the agency there. And Chuck is now teaching drawing at Tyler. And another person was Jack Butler. These were all people. Jack Butler was went to Illinois, was teaching at Illinois, eventually went to Canada, started a print program at Baker Lake in the Northwest Territories for Eskimo, you might say, or what would you call, Inuit artists, in which he set up a print program there to try to get them back to their roots of making prints. And then he went back to Winnipeg, and I'm not sure where he is now. I think he's in Banff or somewhere.
So Carnegie had a strong print program when
you were... It didn't have a strong print. It had a print program. Okay. There were two people teaching prints, Robert Gardner and Joanne Mayer. And Joanne basically taught etching, and they had what was called an introductory to print program. I mean, as an undergrad, I think in your sophomore year, you took introductory to printmaking, and Gardner taught that. And then it was just a very small, under-equipped shop run hand-to-mouth. It was very hot in the summer. It had skylights with no rear air conditioning. And I always find it funny, the students complaining today, because I remember printing many times in 100-degree temperature with your inks flowing all over the place. And the presses were broken. I remember I was using a Fuchs and Lang press that actually had the yoke had broken off of it. And they had welded it back together with steel plates. And he didn't have any money. Carnegie didn't pay very much, although it was a very highly endowed school. But he was holding that program together by bailing wire. He was very committed and very strange kind of man. Very intense, but private, and very interesting in one way. And so that was and then Joanne was a former student, I think, there. And I know in the grad program, they only had 8 students in their grad program, very small. And in those days, they would literally kick people out. And I remember I was one of the 8 people, and two of the people were let go while I was there. And they were really actually quite good, but they felt they weren't, I guess, not what they wanted to. I guess they didn't want to apply a degree to these people because they weren't up to what they called their standards, I guess. So the program, though, was small, and at that time, I think Warrington can attest to it, there wasn't really a big surge in printmaking around the universities. And many of the universities had a sort of a cover program where you could learn lithography, woodcut, etching. But there wasn't any real emphasis like we eventually had here, or a quite elaborate program like we eventually had.
You represent the next generation of the printmaking activity here. Mm-hmm. When you arrived, what sort of influence did Warrington and others have on you, and what kind of encouragement did they give you? How did you feel about the environment?
I thought the environment was very exciting when I got here. I thought there was I thought the students were just terrific, and I keep thinking, well, they were terrific, and I thought that there was a slight letdown from what I was used to at Carnegie, because Carnegie was a professional art school there, and I went to, I think I really was lucky. I went to Carnegie at a time when there was just an amazing amount of interest in art. It was after the Korean War. There was a tremendous sense of optimism, I think, in the country. People really thought of this idea of being artists without the idea of, the idea that there would be any monetary gain from a degree. So a lot of us went to school without any idea what we were going to end up doing with art. The idea was that we wanted to be artists. It's really a bohemian sensibility of what art was about. I mean, all of us lived in kind of attic apartments, ate poorly, and the people that were like the poorest, ate the poorest, were admired. I mean, the person that, you heard of somebody saying, well, he's been drunk all week and has eaten just nothing but a hot dog, but he's been in there working. You know, that seemed to spark people's interest.
Haven't changed much, have they?
And, it was that whole bohemian notion of the artist in the garret. It really was.
Were you a contemporary of Warhol?
He was there just 5 years before me. I had actually seen some of his drawings at the university, and they were very careful line drawings. He drew very well, and they were eventually saw those in those shoe drawings he did when he went to New York. But I think when I got here, the influences I had, I think, was just simply the fact that it seemed very professional, and the students were very good. And I think Warrington set a very good standard of the professional printmaker, showing a lot, working very heavily on his own work. Meeker definitely always had worked. Dean, whether you liked him or not, or didn't like his work, he was always in the studio. And I remember when I was interviewed here, we went out to Dean's studio, and there was Dean with his hair drawn back. I think he had a ponytail and a scraggly, long, brownish beard. And we were yucking it up, and he was printing away. There was a sense that there was activity going on, And the students all were, we had some really good students, and Warrington can attest to the fact that most of them, those students in that, those first 5 years or so, are all around the country now. The Lois Johnson, Russ Gordon types, yeah. They were really very good students. So I think the influence I had was just that I was in a, you know, a top-notch program. I think the only disappointment I had was I had to teach life drawing when I first came here, and I found that the students in life drawing weren't as committed what I expected than what I had come from. But again, I think that was primarily because I came from a professional art school at the time, and I was just lucky when I went to Carnegie. I had some just terrific instructors, and it was a different kind of instructor in the sense that they were they were people that most of them were unmarried. And some of them were gay, and they sort of just drifted around to the department at all hours. And they had no commitment. They all had their studios in the department. And so you'd be working at 9 o'clock at night, and here a couple would come in, you know, and then all of a sudden sit down and you'd get critiqued or something. And so there was this sense that they were always around, and that they could pop in any time. You know, and that you knew that if they weren't here, they were upstairs in their studio. So there was a sense of a kind of urgency there. And they had their favorites, and they had the people they didn't like. And if you were on the favorite list, you were very fortunate, because you know, not, you couldn't do wrong. And so there was a kind of sense that there was a clique, you might say, of what we called the good students against the bad students. I mean, it was very competitive that way. But the teachers were just first rate. You know, the design teachers, the drawing teachers were just terrific. And I just think I'm fortunate, because Carnegie has lost all those people. You know, they either died or have moved on. And it was pretty much a school that was rooted in a traditional art background. You know, I mean, the idea of traditional design and drawing. We had heavy emphasis on design and drawing and color and painting. So it was a very... We even had a guy that taught a techniques course, or what we call a process courses, where the whole semester was spent just on materials that you could use, like what paints did, what kind of mediums you used, what kind of canvases, what papers, what graphites, you see, so that after a semester you had this toolbox of knowledge of materials that... for example, today it seems like students know about a pencil and paper, but they don't know all those nuances in between, you know, the different kinds of materials. So, but I think when he died, that course again was never, I don't think anybody ever took up the slack on that. So the only thing I when I first got here, Warrington was gone, and Vera Claire Van Vliet was taking his place. And she was really a ball of fire at that time. She was really tough on the students, and I know that she had made a big effort to make the place into her own image a little bit for that year. And I know when I first got here, I didn't have a place to work for my, I didn't have a student room, didn't have a classroom. And when I was interviewed, they had shown me a room. And they said this was going to be your classroom.
Where was that?
The education building, the basement of the education. So there was an etching room there, and then there was a litho press, two litho presses pushed in the corner. And they said, well, these are your presses, and then this room down the hall you can use. So when I got here, that room was being used for something. So here I had classes signed up and no room. So what I did is I remember. I started getting Meeker's ire all quickly, because we were grinding our litho stones on his etching table with water and carborundum. And so, of course, after the students were done, these kids would come in with their etching plates, and then all of a sudden be carborundum on their plates, scratching them all up. And so I wasn't starting off very well. I was very ambitious, and I stepped on a lot of toes. And in fact, I remember getting Ray Gleckler very mad at me one time, because I went in to talk to Harvey and said something. I told him that we needed this, we needed that, and he said, well, how come they didn't need that during the summer? They did lithography during the summer. And I said something like, well, that's not my idea of lithography, because, you know, I was mad, I was angry. And that got back to Ray, and Ray remember, cornered me on that, and Ray was very upset that I would, in a sense, impugn his reputation. I remember breaking my back, apologizing. I mean, bending over and kissing his boots, because the last thing I wanted to do was an attempt to try to, ingratiate my own situation. And I know that Dean and I didn't get along for a while because, it was this whole issue with space, you know, and what he knew about it, what I knew about it, and I don't know whether we ever did. I don't know whether that kind of started us off on the wrong foot that never quite ever did get clarified or cleared up. You know. So we started off for the first 2 months just using that room just to get started. And in the meantime, they gave me a room then down in the old journalism building looking over the lake. And Relief Printing and Litho then went over there. And I had a really nice large room, about another third as big as this, but windows looking over the lake. I remember building my own graining sink out of plywood and stainless steel, and had the plumbers come over and connect it up, and just redid the whole room. And then I remember the day we went over with the class who had already started working, we just took everything over there, and the room was all set to go. And so I think we spent several years in there before the Humanities Building.
So you were in on the planning for the Humanities
Building? Yeah, well, the Humanities Building, I had seen the plans of it, and a graduate student and myself used to go over that building all the time when it was in the construction, and I went in and then changed the building plans around. I found out that they had a storage room in my room, like they had in all the rooms, and I realized that that storage room was going to reduce my space. I had to remove that. And then I drew up plans for a graining sink that went all the way across the room that was built right into the building. So we made a lot of little adjustments to try to make the space as agreeable as we could within that, because that space had been designed at a time when Sessler was here, I guess. And generally at that time, of course, Sessler was before Tamarin. And so lithography at that time in the 40s was basically 9x12. 16 by 20 stones with little black and white images on it. And I saw a bunch of these images when I came here because I think somebody had collected them. I don't know whether I still have them. And then by the Tamarin experience, of course, then raised all this up. You know, everybody was working big, splashy, color. So I had to kind of adjust all my equipment to what I called the so-called new paradigm of what lithography was going to be.
So you decided at about that time that lithography was going to be your mm-hmm. primary focus. Mm-hmm. Any reason for that? Is that where you felt the most comfortable?
I guess at the time that was the medium I was working in. Mm-hmm. And also it was the medium I was teaching. So I was both involved, say, in my own work, and then I was involved teaching it. So I had to keep up. I was very involved in all the new processes that I could find. I was looking for new students that were very much involved with lithography. We would visit Chicago with Jack Lemmon's Landfall Press to see what was the latest things that he was doing. I used to take students down there. We'd go to the Art Institute. Warrington and I have some great visits to the Art Institute. We could talk about
The bus
trips to the Art Institute, where we always got left with a bill, no matter what we tried to do. We always got left with the students always overspent. They never would put in enough money, so we'd end up with $100 extras to come
from
up with.
The Greek restaurant.
Right. So, I think I was always interested in it because I think it was a very exciting medium for me at the time because there was something really new about it, the look of it. And I think I always was interested in drawing. I think the stuff that I have in the Elvium if you go to the opening Friday, you'll see basically my stuff really is predicated on, even though they're objects, they're pretty much predicated on a sense of draftsmanship and drawing. And so lithography fit very well into that. And I know that one thing that I really liked about it was that lithography enabled me to print these unbelievable rich value ranges that I couldn't get with pencil. My pencil drawings always seemed to have what I call a number two look. They had a kind of medium look. But for some reason, lithography, they'd fill in slightly a little bit, and then you'd get these unbelievable rich blacks.
Yeah. Yes.
And that. I just was really enthralled with that because I felt it really improved my work. You know, I felt it. I hated to agree that a medium would improve your work, but it seemed like no matter what I drew, once it was printed, it looked better. And I just, you know, and I think like anything, you just got immersed in what it was about and you read everything. I remember getting a couple grants to go to the British Museum to look up old prints. I got a grant to go over to research workshops in Paris. I went to Desjobert, Murillo, all those print shops that were very famous. I found 20 lithostones in London one time in a basement. So, you know, I really got involved in it as much as I could. And the students were very excited about it. And, you know, it seems a little different now, but at that time, I think it was also new to them. And I think really the reason for that is that basically lithography was producing the so-called new Tamarin-esque lithography was producing images that we hadn't quite seen before. Technically, there were things in terms of scale, you know, in the materials. We were using commercial inks, which were very intense. If you look at your prints from the heyday of French lithography, the 1890s to, say, 1910, there's color used by the Impressionists, but the colors are very much mixed with white a lot. There's very little of this intense, like, sort of raw, rich color that you see that commercial inks enable us to use now. So color-wise, scale, materials, a lot of people had, for example, there was seldom any new stuff being invented in terms of working on the stone. Most of these things had been done by commercial printers in the 19th century, but we didn't know about them. So what a lot of people did was did research and found all these materials and things that you could use that had gone out of favor and now had been rediscovered, you see. So I have like a 300-page manual called The British Lithographer that was printed in the 1900s, and it's all full of unusual ways of dealing with the stone that most people didn't even... So we'd read these things and get fired up and try it, you know. A lot of the stuff that people think are new, like these transferring of Xeroxes and stuff by rolling them with ink and everything, were done by commercial printers. Not by Xerox, but they were using letterpress and gumming the paper and then rolling it up with ink and then transferring. So that was done, you know, years ago. So I think it was the process just fit what I was thinking about then. It isn't that I didn't like etching, because I think if I had to say the two, I'd probably like etching just as well. But it was a time I sort of had, because of the way we were broken down, it seemed like I wanted to specialize as much as I could.
Did you feel there was a sense of synergy among your colleagues here, that you were all part of this larger enterprise?
I think so, more than now.
Yeah.
You know, I think, I sense that I think a lot of people were younger then, and a lot of people that I dealt with seemed to have their sights set on eventually going to New York. Victor Cord, for instance, Wayne Taylor at one time, they all had their sights set that they were going to make a splash and go to New York. In fact, Victor did go to New York for a couple years. Wayne went for a year, I think. And I think the fact there was this sense that there was a sense of excitement, and we were getting a lot of visiting artists then that were here for 3 weeks to a month. And they were all the big name artists, so there was a lot of excitement about their lectures, and they would be around the, they would be, you know, in the program all the time. William Wiley was here. I remember I did a print with him. Wayne Thiebaud actually worked next door to me by letting his studio open. He would sit in there with an easel and a model and paint while students could come in, you know. So there was a sense that everybody wanted to be up on things and be on the cutting edge of what ideas were. And I think that was an exciting time. Mm-hmm. And of course then, there was also the Vietnam War protests going on too, which made the university quite a vital place. I remember one time standing on top of the humanities building. We actually could get up there through the maintenance trapdoor and watching the police just wrecking havoc with tear gas and clubs on the mall down here. You know, tear gas things shooting all over the place, just like it looked like Beirut.
In terms of subject matter, did the protests, the Vietnam protests, anything like that, did that influence?
No, it didn't me. It did Bill Wiege, who was here. I mean, Bill did a whole fence. He, you know, that fence that went around the Humanities Building had all kinds of war protests on. He did a print, I think, that covered every bit of the fence. But in my work, I guess I didn't think of my work in terms of a political statement at that time.
What kind of subject matter did you
I think at that time, when I first got here, I was doing automotive, kind of mechanical, using magazines with automotive subject matter, machine forms, and sort of drawing them, kind of disintegrating them, and using them, making them more organic than they were, you know, than, I was fascinated by the parts and the forms. And I think at first I was doing car wrecks. I was photographing all these automobile wrecks. They were interesting because I think they seemed somewhat current or up to date. You know, I mean, it seemed like the automobile was was an essential aspect of our culture. So the idea of these wrecked cars seemed very much an interesting thing. And I started looking at, could I look at something that most people would ignore and bring it somewhat transform it somehow in the forefront. So I kept with those machine form images for a long time. And I did them in etchings, and I did some woodcuts, plastic engravings, a lot of litho's of them.
Does one of these lead to the next one? Is it sort of like...
Yeah, I think that seemed to be something I was excited about, and it seemed like that's the subject matter I looked for. When I went to look at magazines, I always looked at automotive magazines. I always looked at anything that had some type of mechanical structure to it that could be used to... use as subject matter somehow, either in whole or as parts. I distorted the sizes of things. I'd put maybe 50 or 60 objects in one composition, but distort the size. That some things were big, I'd make small. Some things were small, I'd make big. And I felt that this was something, you know, everybody, I think, at that age, you're trying to find something that you feel was an identity. You know what I mean? Like your sort of thing. You know, maybe it was Warrington, he was thinking of famous gangsters. You know, that was like a subject matter that you could, or Dean was thinking of, biblical, Joseph's coats, things like that. So we were all looking for a subject matter that gave us a kind of identity. And then my treatment of those was fairly traditional, though. Although every time I was trying to find ways to use a litho stone that was different, hoping that I could find some different process.
Were there any other printmakers who influenced your work?
Yeah, I think I was influenced by Rauschenberg. I think his use of photographic materials. Bill Wiege influenced me some in a sense of his use of photographic things rather than drawing. And I got into photographic subject matter. I mean, I got into using the subject matter photographically on the stone and plate by watching him work with his photo materials that he was doing on these war protest images. Remember those ones that he was doing, these ones with a horrible war images superimposed with nudie images of women. He'd probably never be able to do it today, but they were like suggestive images of pinups and everything. He would superimpose those in with pictures of Vietnam War and Nixon and things like that. And I liked the idea of how fast he was able to accumulate. And I thought that this might give me a way of getting out of my sort of manneristic style of drawing that I was doing at the time. So I engaged in trying to find images that I could then have Bill photograph, because Bill was our assistant here when I was here. Bill was a grad student. He actually took litho for me one semester, and then he was our technician for a couple years, and while he was a grad student. And then we hired him after he graduated.
Was one of the problems getting stones and having them available?
Yeah, when I first got here, the only equipment we had were those. I think we had four Fuchs and Lang type presses, which were the ones that were almost invented around the turn of the century. One was destroyed, I think, in Larry Junkins's fire that burned down where the old journalism used to be. There was a fire right next to that. One was destroyed there, and then I think I had three or four to start with. And then I bought two new brand presses. We had the money to do that when we moved. So we started with one brand press, eventually went to another one, and then I sort of retired those older presses. We're still using two of the older ones, but I've since then got newer ones to use. So stones, there weren't any big stones. The biggest stone was, you know, 16 by 20. And so I hunted some down. As I said, I went to London one time and found a whole basement of stones in London. And because of they were very cheap, but there was the shipping, the weight of shipping them back. But there was a basement twice as big as this room, stacked with those stones. End to end, just, I mean, like sheaves, you know, just.
And this is a big room for people listening.
Yeah. And that, I remember, that was an unbelievable shop. It was in 1966, and it was on a little alley in London. And when I went into it, it was like going into a room from Hogarth or Oliver Twist. It was so old that there was so much dust in the room from talc and rosin that there was no edges anywhere. There were no corners. The corners had all smoothed out from the accumulations of dust. And it was an old man printing on one of those old Fuchs and Lang press with a light bulb coming right down. And he was printing bowling advertisements that had been typewritten onto transfer paper and then transferred to the stone.
I mean, sounds like one of Warrington's prints.
Well, I was there about that time.
Yeah. And it was no pictures. It was just typewritten lettering. And today you just Xerox that. Here this guy was printing these things by hand. And they were going out of business, and I can see why. And he wanted to know if I wanted to buy these. They even had electric hand litho, electric litho stone press, where you locked a stone in and it had leather rollers that inked up all electrically. And they just threw it away. Nobody wanted it. And our problem was the best we could do was we could afford 20 of these stones. And I remember they were delivered here in a large crate about twice as big as this table and about twice as high. And they had to bring it in with a crane and just dropped it in the basement of the old journalism building. And we uncrated it and we didn't know what to do with these things. They were all just in there, you know. But so we were always on the lookout for stones, although at the time they weren't as expensive as they were now. And I think we found some up in Michigan one time, got one given to us. Sessler, after he died, his daughter gave us some of his equipment. He had a few stones and things. In fact, he had a stone that was in progress when he died that I printed for her. That it wasn't finished, but we processed it and then rolled it up and I did a few copies of it. It was so greasy from being left out, though, it didn't hold up very well.
Is this continue to be a problem, getting that equipment available for the students?
Well, it is, only in the sense that you do have breakage. There's usually a couple stones broken every year, no matter how careful you are. And it's a question then, the money, we just don't have the money anymore in our capital budget to buy new ones. I sometimes hope. I remember one year I sent out 30 letters to try to garner up some money from private industry. Sent it to, you know, beer companies and everything and never got any answer because I was requesting money just to buy stones. But we do use plates and they make up some of them. But the stones are really the nicest. That's my favorite medium to teach lithography on is the stone because it's somehow it's more agreeable. It's students like to work with, except for the weight. But it's a much nicer, more you might say, organic material to work with. It's forgiving and it's you can't destroy it like you can a plate. I mean, you can just scrape on it and redo it. Scrape on it, redo it. So it
doesn't wear down, Greg?
Well, it does, but it allows you tremendous leeway of corrections and stuff. So it's a nice medium to teach it, except in this day and age, you know, it seems so archaic that a lot of students just don't want to even bother with it because it seems so out of touch. I remember one student told me that he'd like to take my course if my presses had buttons on them. Because the idea was that the notion of press with buttons seemed to mean that it was closer to the computer or that it at least was a contemporary machine. The idea that you crank this thing by hand. Right. So,
in a way, you were the replacement for one third of Al Sessler, and that with Sessler's death, his classes were really divided between etching and lithography and woodcut, a relief. So you were replacing him in lithography. Was there any residue from the Sessler period? Did you have people that had worked with him, sort of his methods? Did you have to deal with the sort of the memory of Sessler?
No, I never did. I had heard of him, and you know, I did some research about his work, and I saw his work quite a bit when I was here. But I didn't have, there didn't seem to be any hangover of that. That certainly wasn't anything detrimental. It may be just the idea that maybe he had started some of this, and that he was, without him I wouldn't be there, was the notion. But I was never reminded of him from students, or, and I never saw much of his work. And that may be due to the fact that I'm not sure it was taught much the last year he was alive. I think Ray took over, I know, that summer before I got there. So there may have been
Ray Gleckler,
yeah. So there just may have been enough time lapse where the students that had worked with him had been graduated. But I don't remember at this point running into anybody. I think occasionally a student would come back and say, oh, I had worked with Ray, with Al. But I don't remember working with any student that had worked with him, and so that there was any conflict of ideology there or techniques.
You say Bill Wege was one of your immediate contemporaries. Who else came about that time into the printmaking or shortly thereafter? Or was there another gap then? Fran come next?
Well, it was myself, Warrington, Dean, Ray, and then Phil Hamilton was in graphics, and then Walter.
Yeah.
And Walter, I think, was the last one. Walter was actually hired right after I was, wasn't he?
I think so.
Yeah, right after, yeah. I think. And so I think that's what this, we were all pretty much. Bill came in primarily probably 4 or 5 years after I got here, because he first was here as a grad student, and then he then became our production techniques technician and ran all that camera stuff. And then when he graduated, we needed somebody for that area, and I guess we had a position at that time. I'm not sure exactly how that worked out, but I think then he was hired for that position. But there, I think that stayed fairly constant until Warrington retired then.
How about your relationship with Claire Van Vliet? I brought her in as my replacement. Mm-hmm. I had a grant, I think I was going to be off for a year, and I think it turned into 2 years. But I had seen Claire's work and her classroom at the Philadelphia College, and you know, I was very impressed by what she was doing, particularly her interest in photo methods. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was an area that we really needed to bring in and become more sophisticated in. Mm-hmm. So now I know you were very friendly, mm-hmm. and was there an influence from her on your career?
Well, I think when I got here, this was my first job, and she hadn't taught that much before, so we were closer to the same age, and we basically were the younger group, you might say, her and myself, compared to, say, Dean and Ray at the time. And I was impressed with her, you might say, her vigor in teaching, and she seemed committed to teaching and being an artist. And we got along very, very well, and I've kept that relationship with her right up to the present. In other words, after she was here 1 year, we got along very well and kept in contact. When I went to teach in Montreal, I would look her up because her place in Vermont wasn't very far from school I taught in Montreal. And in the meantime, we did prints together. She would either visit here, or I would go out there, and we would make prints together. And I've done, I think, 3 or 4 editions with her since. and I've kept in contact with her, although I don't see, hear from her as much. But I think she was a good influence in terms of, you know, she was rather tough, no-nonsense kind of individual when it came to teaching. And she didn't have any problems of insulting the students. She didn't find that a problem. And she was very ornery at times, but I think very fair at the same way, you know.
Speaking of teaching, you mentioned that first course you taught. What have been your basic responsibilities in teaching since you came to UW?
Okay, when I first came here, it was lithography and life drawing. And then it's gone from, I've always taught at least one section of lithography since I've been here. And other times I've taught life drawing, basic drawing, intermediate drawing, seminars, and illustration. So those are the range of things that I've taught since I've been here.
Auto mechanics, you teach that?
No, not. And I think I change it around just so that it makes it a little more interesting, you know, so it's not always. My favorite class is the beginning litho class because they are beginners, and most of them really, I somehow get there's a lot of enjoyment out of these people. They come with no idea what the process is, and then they leave being able to at least do it. There's a sense of, you know, there's a kind of a sense of tangible results here, where so much of teaching art is subjective. You know what I mean? It's you don't know whether you're making any progress with a person sometimes. Where this beginning class, I can give, I like teaching in a structured environment. I don't know, maybe that's just my personality, but I don't like a free-for-all kind of situations. I never liked it where two students come and go as they please, and I'm sort of try to plug into that. I like the beginning class because it meets judiciously twice a week. The students are there all the time, and I give them assignments. I give them about 8 different projects to do, and that's they know what they have to do, and then, you know, that's the way it is. And it seems to me that's where I function better.
That's kind of reflected in your work, as there's a high degree of precision and symmetry there. Is that part of your...
I think so, probably. It's probably a personality thing. It's just that I know the students, like my advanced class students, all like to do it independently, where they come and go. But I figure that there's so much information I've got and the way I could help, that they're missing something if they're not there all the time. But they don't seem to mind that, and I've always found that unusual, because they are, in a way, striving for printmaking. And I have 25 years of printmaking under my belt of information and techniques and artists that I work with, and every class time I try to engage these students on this level, but you find that most of them, and on the advanced level, would rather come in work independently. I think Warrington probably experienced that too, is it? They don't like the idea of being given all projects. And the only reason I give them projects is that I can't get enough work out of them, I feel otherwise. You know, so if you let them go and just say, well, we want to do what we want to do, it seems like they don't cover very much ground. So my idea of giving them a project now and then is to see if I can open up the vast store of information and possibilities the process has. Now, they don't like to do that, but... it seems to me that my job is just to expose them to as much information as I can, you know, rather than worrying about whether they're happy with that or not.
Are these mainly graduate students we're talking about?
Mm-hmm. Mostly. There was a time, I think, where you didn't have you. I very seldom did less projects. I think with the earlier when I first came here, because I think the students were much more prone to experiment and be more excited about things.
Earlier, yeah. Mm-hmm. What do you account for change? How do you account for change?
Well, I just think, you know, Warrington probably has some thoughts on that as well as everybody that teaches. I guess the students are just different now than they were, you know, and I don't know, you know, you can say it's what, you know, it's their upbringing, the training, the high schools, the family. They are different, though. In one way, the talent isn't any different because, you know, that's, we might say that's genetic. We all have talent, and you know, there's no, we don't have a culture that has talent and a culture that doesn't. So talent, I think, remains fairly constant. And I think my ability to teach these beginners, lithography hasn't changed. In other words, I think the 10 kids that are in there now probably know it at this point in the semester almost as well as the 10 kids when I first came here. But it's harder work. I mean, you work harder to get them to that level. And I think some of that's because a lot of the process is technical, and it takes a certain amount of just physical and technical dexterity that the kids aren't getting now. For example, in Warrington, we worked on our cars when we were young. I had to work on a car, or else I wouldn't go out to school. Kids today wouldn't know which end of the car to where the hood is. You see what I mean? So you know, you have things like, when you say tighten the pressure down, they don't know which direction to turn to tighten, you know, which seems to me is like a fundamental knowledge in life, that you have to know that you unscrew something to take it off and screw it the other way to tighten it. But a lot of them just don't even know those simple things. But as I said, the talent's there, except that I don't think we're getting as many talented people, and there are several reasons for that. I think everybody is job conscious now. So if you have somebody that's a super draftsman or something, they'll probably opt to go into illustration or something. And I probably, if I was their advisor, probably would tell them that. You know, I think art's something you feel a calling for. But if it's a choice, should I do this or do that? And I would probably say, well, do something you could probably make money at. And I think that's one of the things. So that a lot of the students, I think years ago, as I talked about that bohemian lifestyle, doesn't appeal to students today.
I was just going to bring that up, art for art's sake.
No, you don't see as much of it. Now, there's, you know, I don't mean there isn't some. I would say, like, for example, up there now we have 50 kids in printmaking. I'd say there's about 10 really good students out of the 50 in graduate. You know, if I had my way, I'd get rid of the other 40, but I can't. So, but on the other hand, those 10 are probably as good as any of the people we've ever had. You know, they're good students. But I think a lot of the students today, if you're a very good printmaking student, you're looking for a university to go to, you can shop around and you can get a TA somewhere where we can't offer those right off the bat, say. And I think it was more competitive back in the 60s where everybody wanted to learn printmaking, and they just wanted to go to a good place. And I think Warrington probably knows this. The sort of the aura of Wisconsin is kind of wearing a little bit because we're getting into a new generation that doesn't know the reputation we used to have. You see, it's still very good. I mean, every place I go to as a visitor or something, you know, they always remark about the good students we turn out here. But I know recently I'm having more and more trouble turning out the printmaking type that we used to. The students are much broader now, which in one way I think creatively is probably better, but it doesn't help our program in prints as much, because what's happening is we're not getting the person that's really going to roll up their sleeves and just do etching or just do lithography and really push it to a, you know, a beautiful result.
Is this an experience that's common across the country?
I see a lot of it, because I'll tell you why I know it's somewhat around. I never used to get letters from people, friends who are teaching, who want to. They're asking me, do I have any good undergrads? They have money to give them. And I know Warrington would probably know that, is that back in the 70s, we never got letters, very seldom like that, because it was, the kids were willing to go where they wanted to, you know, or were willing to pay to go. Now, a lot of them, like for example, we placed two kids last year at the University of Illinois, full tuition, TAs, and they couldn't fill that position until I heard about it up in, I think it was like a month before school started. And so I think there is something that has changed. You know, there's obviously a change in the art styles. You know, a lot of the students are interested in art that's more political, which I don't understand why printmaking wouldn't be a perfect ploy for that, considering its history. But it may be that art goes, you know, obviously art goes through a lot of fashion, and it may just not be a fashionable medium as well now. And so you're always going to have your eccentric students that want to work in something that might be so-called out of date. But knowing the way printmaking goes, in another year or so, it may come back in a flourish like it was in the 60s and 70s, you see. It goes through cycles. The history of litho has been one up and down all through history. You know,
where is it now in the relative?
Well, I think printmaking generally has taken its, I don't think it's sort of anywhere. What I mean, it's not high or low. I think it's sort of in the curriculum now, like it used to be. And yet we've got it, it's much higher developed in the curriculum than it was back before Sessler. But it's in that curriculum situation where I don't think the idea of you being a printmaker held as much weight as it used to, you know, that in a sense of the weight, in a sense of the student wanting to commit themselves just to prints.
What about national centers of activity at the college level?
Well, I think they're all going through what we're going through, and that is they're cutting back. As people retire, they're not replacing them. There's several printmaking departments that have closed down, I know, or have gone out. I know Anne Marie Carlson just wrote me a letter, and she's been at UCLA, and she's been fighting quite heavily to keep that program, and she told me that they're going to probably let her go at the end of next year. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, Clinton Klein out at University in Colorado in Boulder has just been having a terrible time keeping his program. They're trying to get rid of him. You know, they're humiliating him, reducing his salary, anything to get rid of him, you know. Now, again, that may be personality things as well as other things, but there is an interest in, you know, getting into, you know, what the so-called next generation of making art's going to be, and most schools want to be on that cutting edge, whether it's going to be media, you know, purely conceptual things or what. So printmaking's got a, you know, a problem there in terms of how we're going to fit in. I think we'll always have people that are interested in it. There's no question there. But it may be a while before it returns, in my view, to what it was, say, when I first got here. I think it's kind of taken a level. You know, there's a sort of a leveling off it's taken, as I said. But it's some way it's disappointing, but something it's sort of inevitable. You know, that any process or any interest is going to wane. It's always going to, you know, because we're in a culture that everything is so excitable for a few, you know, for a short time. But I'm sort of disappointed a little bit because I feel that my interest in it is just as high, or my interest in teaching it is just as, I mean, I'm not certainly not bored with it, or I don't have the energy, but it's just that you don't get quite the commitment out of the students, reinforcement that you used to get from the students. Mm-hmm. And I think you get a little bit cynical because of that, and the students might pick up on that, and then that becomes that vicious circle, you know. But because in my case, I try to teach through example, you know, the idea that I'm involved, I'm there all the time, I'm eager to work with a student. I might not have always the right answer for them, but I figure that's the way I teach. I teach through example that I'm involved in it.
You also teach with the critique. And, you know, to my knowledge, you are a legendary critiquer. You know, I've heard students go on and they come out of your critique sessions glowing and arguing and fighting. How do you feel about that as an instrument?
And how do you structure it?
Well, I do it different ways. For example, sometimes critiques are individual, obviously, and then others they're group. I figure the way I structure the group is simply that I choose a group critique a lot if I feel that I'm going to cover ground that everybody should be involved in. In other words, general issues of art making and ideas. So and rather than repeat myself 10 or 12 times, I try to make it into a group thing where I can cover and use somebody's work as an example to make a point that relates to all of their work. And most of the critiques I usually, sometimes I start and say, well, I'm going to look at this work as if it's I'm a critic going into a gallery, and I'm going to just say what I think, you know, not good or bad, but what I think about whether I'd write about this or not. Others, I ask them first what they're doing, and then we go into that. Other times, I have the students critique the work, or I have the student, there's all kinds of little things. You can ask the student to, you know, one student talk about all the positive things in the work and then have somebody else talk about any of the negative things in the work. I try to also talk about the work in terms of, I hate to use the word, effective and non-effective rather than good and bad. I don't like to use the term that the work is good or the work is bad. I don't feel that's, I think that's prejudicial and It's the same as me saying, I like white wine, you like red wine. It's irrelevant in a way. It's a taste thing. So I try to talk about it in relation to looking at the work, understanding what the student is doing first, and then deciding by what I understand what they're trying to do, whether they've succeeded or failed, and then if they have, what could I add to maybe make it more along the line, more effective the way they're working. So I can look at a work, and if I notice they're trying for a certain kind of look or idea, we talk about that, and then I'll talk about whether it works or it doesn't. And in terms of, I think I could be better at giving them more alternatives or advice after the critique, meaning that a lot of times I can tell them what's wrong with the work, but I'm not sure I can always tell them what the next step is. Although, and sometimes I keep thinking that's really their problem anyway, you know. But I've had students come and say, gee, I really like the critiques, but after it's over, I'm sort of stuck. I don't know what to do. You know, I'm stymied. You've told me some good things, but I don't know what to do next. You know, I have had that kind of response. And I like to talk about, I don't like to lie to the students in any way. I mean, if I really don't like a piece of work, I won't tell them that. I won't say I dislike it. But I won't say they're doing a good job just to get over with. You know, I won't just placate the student, even if it's hard to do.
Okay.
First of all, I look for, in printmaking, it's technique as one possibility. For example, the technique has to be a given. No good print will work if the technique's lousy. So if it's printed poorly, you're behind the eight ball to begin with. So we take for granted that it's printed well. If it isn't, I talk about why it's not printed well. But that's usually a given. That, you know, it has to be printed adequately or else you can't read it. So then I go into intent. I try to discover what the intention of the work is and whether they're succeeding with intent. And then scale of the work. Is it the right scale? Is the medium used the correct way? Does the work have mystery? Is it up to date? I mean, does it reveal something about the artists and their times? I feel very strongly that all art today, Richard Long and I always get in an argument. Richard said you couldn't really do a work today without having it up to date. And I don't know, my argument is you could, but I like to look at work in which, if the person's even working on a still life or landscape, can they bring something into it that reveals something about living in 1994? I mean, I feel the pressures and the attitudes that we're up against today, the media, the influences. Somehow, even if you're doing a little still life, something's going to enter in there somewhere. So I'm looking for an awareness on the student about their own life, the life they're living in, I mean, the times they're living in, and then their awareness of art. In other words, art comes from art. So I speak a lot about, have you looked at certain artists, suggest artists to look up. Because I think that's one of the things I've noticed is my earlier groups that I had when I was talking about in the 70s, the students seemed to be much more up on the artists that were in. Everybody knew who was doing what. Students today are very, very shallow on that. You can mention almost anybody and they won't know anything about them. And you've got to know that because it gives you a sense of where you're at, your own proportion. In other words, who you relate to, how are they doing what you're doing better? How are you doing what they're doing better? Where do you fit in? Is there a niche that you can go? You see, is there a point? It's a little bit contrived, but on the other hand, it does give you a sense of opportunities and possibilities. See what I mean? I mean, it gives you a sense of what's out there, the capabilities. For example, you know, you may be, if you don't know what's going out there, you may be sitting there for years doing something that somebody's already, you know, scored in the market on. You know, I don't mean the market, but I mean, no, has already covered so much better. In other words, if you had a student that's doing M.C. Escher type of inner reactions of things, if they're not aware of Escher, I mean, it'd be good for them to be aware of them if they're interested in that kind of thing.
How many students over the years have you felt are really distinctive talents? You mentioned the 10.
Not that many. Not that many, but mm-hmm. There's a lot of good ones. But I don't think those real distinctive talents come along very often. Yeah. You know, I think they are rare.
Yeah.
we have a lot of people that are very, very good and now are teaching. Warrington could speak to that. But whether, you know, when you say about rare talents, you know, somebody exceptional that's unique, a genius type, very few. I don't know.
Some of the special ones that you maintain a relationship with after they leave and they really become friends, I think we all have those. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a number of them we share. Could you speak about some of them? In other words, your network, the people that have a relationship to you and the work they did here, and then they kind of pay off sometimes. Mm-hmm. They help the old school send us good.
Well, there was almost in all parts of the country, I have former students that are teaching. For instance, Anne-Marie Carlson is out in UCLA. What's her friend at Long Beach? Cindy, what was her name?
Yeah, I know who you mean.
You know, then Bunny Scapator, Bunny Lark, Sylvia Lark was out there before she died.
Yeah.
Shirley Shear is now in the University of Washington, Seattle. Osborne's at, Cynthia Osborne is there. She's at Long Beach. And these are all people that were grad students of Warrington and ours. And mine, and we get students and letters from them all the time. In the Midwest area, who do I know that we've been working with here?
Well, you worked a lot with Beauvais.
Beauvais is down in Knoxville, Tennessee. He was going to, Barb Tissera's in VCI, Virginia Commonwealth. Jerry Donato's down there.
And then into
and then several of them up in New England, Jane Goldman and Kathy Kernan are up there.
Boston,
in the Boston area, and Diane Fines at SUNY New York, Plattsburgh, SUNY Plattsburgh.
I mean, most of them seem to be teaching, but then into the print shops, for example,
right. Zishwa Sikora, Art Werger.
I was thinking of Ken Farley.
He was one of the
terrific talent as a printer more than as an artist.
But there's, you know, we have, you know, and then Gene Saunders is out at Penn State. What's the other girl that's working with her?
You know, I don't know. You know at Penn State?
Yeah,
too?
You know who that is. She's in the portfolio. Robin Gibson. Yeah, and then Harshman is down in Georgia somewhere. I guess they're trying to start a new portfolio like we had,
for
Points of Departure. So they're trying to start a new one with some more recent people.
This project had pretty good legs to it, didn't it? The Point of Departure project. It went around the country for a couple years, didn't
it? Yeah, and I thought it was a really ambitious and very well done project, and I thought it was a unique kind of project, and I think Warrington should take most of the credit for that, because sort of his idea along with those students, and thought that it was...
I think it was very much a shared project.
But I think that, I guess my only disappointment in that portfolio was just the fact that I just felt that some of the students didn't do their best work. You know, that actually we had better work, but I thought that the quality of it, I mean, the technical quality was very, very good. I was just disappointed on a few things.
Images,
just why, because I thought it would have been really super. For example, Greg Page, I thought, did some wonderful work when he was a litho person here, but I felt his image in that book wasn't as strong as some of the things he had done as a student here. But that's the issue with portfolios. You know, a lot of them, you're under the gun. A lot of people don't like the pressure of them. And I've never done very good work in them, so I can understand that. So. In fact, she called me just the other day and wanted to know if I wanted to participate, and I said no, because I just felt that maybe that was that one portfolio was all we needed. I don't know if we need another one. So
I wondered if you could round up the usual suspects, enough of them, for this time around.
I think you get wary about the portfolios because, you know, finally you have to do them, and it's a tremendous effort. Mm-hmm. If you have to print a whole edition, yeah. and then most of the edition is shared with the people in the portfolio. But it's fun to do, though, but a lot of work. And I think the point of departure was a really tremendous thing. It circulated for 3 years, and mostly to university galleries, museums, and there were two separate shows. So it really had a lot of exposure.
Are there any shows or competitions in the country now that give you that sort of view of what's happening now on a regular basis? There's the one at Bradley University, I know.
Yeah, I think the Bradley's probably the one that's held on the longest. Mm-hmm. It's there used to be one, for example, in Seattle, there used to be an international print competition every year when I first got here that was very big, and that's gone now. There was one at Silvermine in Connecticut, which was, I think, Pederty originally was involved in that. And, of course, the Philadelphia Print Club also always had their international. But now they've kind of changed that to, they have it this year, but what it is you send slides in, and then if they pick your work, they then ask you to send a portfolio, and then they show some of the portfolio. So it's going to be a smaller show with more work representing like younger artists that are maybe emerging or something. But I think you're right. Probably the Bradley is the only one that's held on as long. That can you think of any other one that's?
Well, I like Color Print USA.
That's right, Color Print USA,
which is done about every 4 years. Mm-hmm. And
there used to be the Boston Printmakers, but I don't know. I haven't heard about that recently.
Who does the color print?
That's Linden.
Linwood Krennic.
Crank at Texas Tech University.
Mm-hmm. They just put out a nice big color catalog I just got on that show.
Yeah.
It would sort of work from all the years, I guess.
For a university, it's a great effort, mm-hmm. and because you have to raise a lot of money. Mm-hmm. They're expensive to do.
And then one of the big ones used to be the Library of Congress competition, but that's since gone, by the way.
Yeah.
And when Gene Barrow was here, he had he was the adjunct curator of Carnegie Mellon and Brooklyn Museum, and he used to have a biannual, or whether it's triannual, every 3 years at the Brooklyn Museum, which was like the survey of the whole country. And he got under fire on that because, again, he catered primarily to printmakers. And in New York, you know, they like the prints by the blue chip artists, you know, that are the sort of painters that make prints. So he used to be criticized on the quality level or the interest level of those shows, although I thought they were fine.
You know. Do you think that pressure somewhat corrupts the product? That is, the big galleries who publish the celebrities with the idea that this will be a big seller, so artistically, I think we've spoken about this before, Warrington, you sort of visualize that market out there as opposed to doing what you really want to do in that environment.
Well, I think the idea right now that if you were a pure printmaker and you wanted to break into a New York gallery would be almost impossible.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, most people that are running these galleries are smaller galleries now. There's almost all of the mid-range galleries have closed in New York. The only thing that's left is the blue chip galleries and the emerging artist alternative space galleries. The middle, Barbara Toll just closed up last month, and she had been around for years.
And this is just the last 2 or 3 years,
yeah.
Is that
she's
right?
She would be like a gallery that would have supported artists who sell paintings in the $2,000-$3,000 range, you see. And now most of those artists have jumped up to bigger and better places or dropped out altogether. So the idea of me going to New York with prints, it would just be a dead end. And as I said, most of the gallery owners there really don't know how to look at prints anymore. They're not interested in them. And then they'll give you a simple argument that I had given to me once, and that is, I took a suite of prints once to Richard Gray Gallery in Chicago, and I said, and the woman looked down, and they had a print curator at the time, and she said, "Gee, these are wonderful. How much do you want for them?" I said, "Well, there's six of them. I think I'd need around, I think it was $2,000 for the whole set, box set, $1,500 or $2,000. And she said, well, that's reasonable. But she said, what you're up against is I can sell one Oldenburg for that price. Yeah. And she said, who's going to buy this if they can get one old? Because you're nobody. And she said, that's what we're up against. You see, you'd have to make this somehow, you'd have to find a more advantageous way of marketing your work, you see. And I think that's why most people that are in the universities get most of their reputation and showing appetite out of the way by sending to national competitions. And they come and go. Like this year, there seems to be a lot of them out there now. And last year, there weren't as many. The year before last, there weren't as many. But there's somehow it's come back now. And I guess if you're smart and you're in a university, you can make some money on them. If you charge like a $20 entry fee, and you get, say, 1,000 or 2,000 entries, and you could probably make a little bit of money, but it's a lot of work, because Warrington, I think, did it once or twice with
twice.
American.
American graphics.
Yeah.
Is it a lot of work?
It's a lot of work. You do it once, and you say, never again. And then about 5 years later, you think, gee, we really enjoyed that. And what a great teaching tool. Because, of course, it's the students that do the show and put it together.
My feeling, though, about these print shows is that Warrington might have a different viewpoint on it, but my feeling is that there's one side of me that really likes the idea of having stuff in the mail and getting a little catalog. And I think in order to keep my name into the swing of the circle of people, I've got to keep doing it. But I think in terms of getting anything really out of it, I don't think you get much out of it. You get a lot of money and a lot of damaged prints, a lot of slides that you never get back. And I don't think really it helps much of your reputation as an artist. Although, you know, all the printmakers we know, we sort of know their work, so it does help somewhat. But I don't really send to these shows much anymore because of the... I'll give you an example. I was invited to go up to South Dakota a couple months ago and show in this alternative printmaking show. And when I weighed the amount of driving, taking these plastic boxes up, they're probably getting them damaged, and the amount of people that were going to look at that show, it didn't seem worth it. I didn't do it.
What is the most important thing to you as far as getting your work known and your reputation?
I think it's more word of mouth more than it is because...
But I mean, is it permanent collection acquisition?
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
Probably museum situations. I haven't had much luck in gallery situations, you know. For example, I love the idea of the faculty show because it's a nice big museum space and it'll probably get seen by more people than any other show I'll be in all this for the next 3 or 4 years. So I like that, but I think Warrington's taken sort of a different view of this in a way from what in your work, I think Warrington just sends a lot more stuff on. I think it's work for him. I think in my case, I was always sort of caught in between, should I send or shouldn't I? And sometimes I did, sometimes I didn't. I think you either got to do it one way or the other. If you're going to send, you send everything, and you send a lot of times. And that's a good way, I think, to get your reputation around.
I'm much more selective now.
Yeah, but that's what I mean. I think at one time, though, you send a lot more to...
Right.
What was available, which I think was a good idea. I mean,
I enjoyed the shows and the catalogs. You know, in a way, it's fighting the isolation that you're in here as the sort of isolated artist or isolated group. There was this community among printmakers that I always enjoyed.
Yeah, that's true.
And catalogs would come back.
You'd know everybody in the catalog.
Yeah,
and then it got to be a point, I think, about 5 years ago where I started getting catalogs. I didn't know anybody. And then I started to send some more. Because I felt I'd better start.
And they started charging you for the catalog. Right. That was even worse.
Well, I think everything's changing. Everything's changed and the change is continuous. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of new situations now.
Sure.
There are more invitational shows. There are more theme shows, specialized shows. We were both in this show in Portland, for example, where we ran down Bob Packwood.
Yeah, the Packwood.
And that had
diary.
A fascinating catalog. I have to show that. I think I sent you.
No, I didn't.
Did I?
I saw the title in Jack's video.
Yeah,
there.
Yeah. and it got a lot of publicity.
Yeah, he's from Portland, so they did this show called The Packwood Diary.
Yeah, and that was in the Wall Street Journal. Did you know that?
Was it written up in the Wall Street?
It was written up in the Wall Street Journal.
How did you depict that, as an auto part or what?
No, what I like about these theme shows is it just forces me to approach ideas from a different angle. Mm-hmm. And Warrington was saying, we've also been in these theme shows down in the Wiston Museum, mm-hmm. which this guy that runs that place down in Racine, he seems to come up with all these strange, like one was on sports, one was on pets. The newest one is on domestic tranquility, I guess. It's like house.
It must be a one-picture show.
I already got an idea for that. It's going to be called Honey, I'm Home. And it's going to be a guy coming home and his wife's in bed with another guy. I already got that idea figured out. And what it does is, in order to make that image, I'll have to switch gears again.
Yeah.
See, I'll have to go back to maybe drawing and stuff. Yeah. Where the Packwood Diary, I made an object. What I did is I thought of the idea of diary, so I got a little book and I sliced it on the bandsaw. And when I cut it in half on the bandsaw, what happened is that when it got cut, it just flared right out. So I had two flared, fan-like things. So I put them together back to back, and I put them on a aluminum stand with a thumb screw that tightened them down. And you know, the idea of just compression, sort of metaphor for, you know, what these diaries were about in terms of trying to get the information out of it. So, and then on top was a little round, I had a cue ball. I had a billiard set at home, and I took the cue ball and the eight ball, and the bottom is the eight ball, and on top's the cue ball, and the cue ball has literature from My Secret Life, the anonymous 19th, did you ever read that?
Yeah.
Anonymous 19th century, it's sort of a Victorian, sort of, I guess they'd call it pornography now, but it's actually in the British Museum, so it's not, it's beautifully written, mm-hmm. I thought. And I just took excerpts of it, and then there's a wire that comes out of it, goes to a timer, and the ball is supposed to be an explosives device, and the timer actually has a clock in it, and it runs.
Nice.
And the idea was that this information is explosive. You know, I mean, I try to use any of the metaphors to make, sort of take the metaphor, you know, the literary metaphor, make it into something visual.
Some of your work does involve this construction.
Mm-hmm.
How did you get into that, and when?
Well, I think I got into that with just the idea. I think those constructions have been sort of misunderstood in a way, in a sense that I saw them as a printmaking extension,
mm-hmm.
meaning they were done in order to say, what could you do with printmaking? Rather than, I guess I got bored with just a flat image.
Yeah.
So that's why I got into making objects and stuff. And so the print constructions were meant to take an edition of prints. See, I would print 10 images, and then 10 other images, and then 10 other ones. And then I would cut up those 10 images and construct a fourth image that was unlike any of the other three. And if I had enough of the edition, I could actually make a fourth edition from the materials of the other three prints. And for example, in the art in the show at the Elvium today, there's some pieces in that print of a prints that I'd done 15 years ago that I have used over and over again in my construction, because I made 20 of them. So anytime I need materials, I just cut it up. And the idea was, it was the idea of extending the notion of the prints into three dimensions. However, you could have probably done some of the same thing just by painting paper with color and then cutting that up. But there's something about the printed page that does have a certain rarefication to it that I find interesting. The big problem, I think, the misunderstanding was that as people saw them more decorative, meaning that that wasn't my intent, but I guess I should have made covers and stuff if I didn't want that association different. But now what's interesting is that, I don't want this to sound like it's a sexist comment, but my sales of those things have always been to women. Women have bought them. And I think they see them more related to quilting and things that is weaving, because they see these paper strips as interweaving the way you would do quilts and things. But that was really never my intention of them. Mm-hmm. I saw them more on a theoretical basis rather than I saw them as a theoretical idea of what printmaking could do as an extension of the flat two-dimensional print. In other words, using additions to make single, rare, unique objects. You see, we're using additions to make a different kind of addition. So in other words, I couldn't have made those constructions unless I had additions of prints, because one piece of paper wouldn't have done it. And I actually made a couple, I made several of them that sold. I made copies of them by cutting up the prints the same way and copying one to the other, you see, just so I'd have an addition of one or two. For example, when I had my one person show at the print club, I somehow told Lois Johnson that, well, for helping me put my show up, you can have a print. And I thought, of course, she would take a flat one, but she took one of my only copies of one of my favorite three-dimensional prints. So when I came home, I didn't have any more, so I had to go root through all my drawers and find all the raw materials to make a new one. Because I just happened to like it, you know. So, and that's how they got started. And it was the idea, I guess, I've always had an interest in collage. You know, the idea of putting things together. In fact, in the faculty show here, I've got a Van Gogh image that might interest some of you. It's a Xerox collage of Van Gogh lifting weights. And when you look at it, it literally looks like it's a Van Gogh painting lifting weights. I mean, I've been very clever about, you know, superimposing his head in with his weightlifter's body and that. So it's really a collage as well as it's a drawing. And I've always had interest in this idea of cutting things up and putting them together. And I have a drawing machine that you'll see that was in the Wisdom Show. I don't know if you ever saw it. It's a big pencil. It sits on it. It's 7 feet high. It looks like an action pencil is this big around. It looks like a machine. And it's, again, back to it's like a construction. I don't even know if it's art. It looks more like model making. But it's like a collage. You know, it's like putting this stuff together from parts and pieces. I like the idea of researching, you know, finding all this. I go to the hardware store and look through boxes and find all these things that I don't know what they're used for, and come back and paint them and put them somewhere else. In fact, if I had some money, I'd buy everything in the hardware store, you know, one of everything. And then because just going out and hunting through hardware stores, it'd be nice if you had it on hand.
Yeah. Maybe we...
I want to ask one question.
Is there any more things about the school or something, yeah, rather, or that would help you in your book more? I don't know if any of this helps you.
We're certainly, I mean, primarily we're going to be writing about you.
This is just the front end.
It is the work.
Sure.
I just have to ask this one question. I got a copy of your resume from the art department, and under the lectures I noticed that you gave a lecture in 1987, Madison's attorney office for the investigation of print fraud.
Yeah.
Why don't you talk about that for
a minute? Well, that was... I remember that very well because Warren Moon was involved, and it's funny because I'm not going to go into that, but it's what it was is that there apparently were several galleries in town here that were dealing. One was this, Broden and Andre.
Yeah.
Or Andre was right in that corner next to
the right side of the street,
right near Ella's Delicatessen. And apparently, I don't know if she was involved in any of the shady dealings. I don't think so, because I think what her problem was that she had gotten some prints and then didn't know what they were. Mm-hmm. After, for example, she came over to my house one day, or I had me over, and said, "I got to show you this Chagall." And she showed me Chagall, and then she picked out another and said, "How about this one?" It was the same print. I looked at both and it was just slight different color. Maybe the yellow was a little green or something. And she said, "This print was $4,000, this one's $40,000. And I said, "Well," and she says, "there's a problem here." And then I got my glass out, and of course the cheaper one was a photo reproduction of the other one, done on the same paper with the same signature. And you couldn't tell the difference unless you had a magnifier. What they did is they photographed the real one and color separated it, and then just printed it on the same paper, the same covers. And it brings up some interesting questions about originality and stuff. Like, for example, if you look at a print and it looks identical to the other one and you can't tell it unless you have a glass, is it really a forgery? You see, it is a forgery, but does it matter when it's really, it's everything Chagall had in the original, you see, except it's done a different way. And I think what happened with this other place was that they were dealing with phony Salvador Dali prints. Mm-hmm. That's what it was.
That was it. Yeah.
And what they were doing apparently were They were unbelievably good forgeries. They were phony etchings that literally were embossed and everything. They were done photographically, and then they would probably emboss them after the look. And they were really very well done. And apparently, the story goes that when Dali was near death, he apparently signed a lot of paper. They gave him all this money just to come in there and just sign blank sheets of paper. And then when he was dead, they just did whatever they wanted with the paper. So that lecture was really about the police came, and they wanted to know how this could be done and wanted to know what the processes were. And so Warren Moon got involved, I think, and brought these people over. And I gave them a demonstration on lithography and how you could forge it and how, you know, how you go about doing that. And they would show me the prints, and I'd say, well, this is how you could tell that this is a forgery or this isn't. And you usually look for the photographic dot pattern in them if it's a halftone. Although they're so good at it, like, for example, a lithograph by Ray Dawn could be photographed and probably printed hand. You probably, unless you were an expert, probably wouldn't be able to tell the difference, because if you shot a line shot of that litho, it would just photograph the crayon dots, and those would reproduce exactly like you see them. And if you printed that off of a plate onto really good paper, it'd be very, very difficult to tell the difference, unless you could just tell it's a new print versus, you know, it wouldn't have any aging look to it. But they're so good, they can even age the paper and stuff. You know, so it's probably very unusual. It's not unusual how many artworks that are around that are probably forgeries that we don't even know about, don't even think about. I mean, every year you read about some painting being discovered in some museum as some expert now is claiming it's a forgery. So,
that gallery is out of business now.
Yeah, I think he got into trouble. Now, I don't know whether like he was involved in that knowingly or whether he was involved not knowing it. You know, I don't know what the story was. But that's what that lecture was about. It was to try to deal with the notion of forgery. But it does bring up that question, you know, when you those Chagalls that Broden had, you couldn't really tell the difference. You could only